Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In February 2013, we hosted Richard Murnay, who is Thompson Professor of Education and Society at the Harvard School of Education and a research associate for the National Bureau of Economic Research. His work examines how the growth in family income inequality in the U.S. has affected educational opportunities for children from low-income families.
I'm going to talk about this paper that I wrote for the Journal of Economic Literature. It's coming out in a few months in that journal. It's also currently an NBER working paper, so it's available. High school graduation rates. This is a quote from President Obama from his State of the Union message in 2009 about the importance of high school graduation rates and not dropping out. Now, how do they compare to other OECD countries? In 1965, U.S. ranked first among OECD countries. It had the highest high school graduation rate. It now is below the OECD average. And it's not that high school graduation rates in the United States have declined. I'll show you that in a minute. In fact, they've increased over the last decade for reasons I'll talk about. But don't fully understand. I don't think anyone does yet, which is an interesting aspect for new research. The real story is that in many OECD countries have increased secondary school completion rates quite dramatically over the last 20 years, which kind of helps refute this argument, you know, we've done all we can, we're as high as we can go, we're kind of at a plateau. Other countries have done considerably better in terms of increasing high school graduation rates in the U.S. So another question is, why do we care about these things? Well, first, increases in educational attainments to the U.S. workforce have fueled economic growth and produced rising incomes. The best documentation of that, in my view, is Larry Katz and Claudia Golden's terrific book, The Race Between Education and Technology, well worth a careful read. The other reason that's particularly of interest to me is that education is the primary mechanism of upward social mobility in the United States. And throughout really all of the 20th century, economic growth was a rising tide that, in some sense, lifted all boats up until about 1970. And a key reason for that was that each generation of Americans had, on average, more education than their parents. How many of you have more education than your parents, educational attainments? That's true for me as well. And there's a nice paper in this volume, With Our Opportunity, that Greg Duncan and I edited, showing that the percentage that there really has been a decline in intergenerational upward mobility, the rate of upward mobility in educational attainments in the United States, is by Mike Hout of Berkeley. And so it really, this primary mechanism of upward mobility really is threatened by this stagnation in the high school graduation rate. Scott, thank you. All right.
So your last slide talked about graduation rates across countries. And so, do we have a good sense if what a high school graduate is the same across countries? And could the mechanism be it's getting easier to get high school diplomas in certain countries versus others? Or any thoughts on or knowledge on that?
I don't really know, Scott. I've talked to folks at OECD. Andreas Schleicher, who runs that program, talks about the large amount of effort they put in measuring these things. I don't think that's the case, but I don't know for sure. So in particular, is it the case that they changed the definition of high school graduation rate in particular countries, and that has contributed to this? It's a good question. I really don't know the answer. So one of the other questions this paper addresses, first of all, how do you measure high school graduation? It turns out that's a non-trivial proposition. The second is, what are the stylized facts, so to speak? You want to explain, I want to describe six that I think are quite striking. Then how can we explain these patterns? Then, of course, the question of, well, what are promising strategies to increase high school graduation rates? In other words, what's the evidence, the causal evidence on things that have been tried, and to the extent to have they made a difference? And then finally, a few words on, as we'll see, my answers to the fourth question about promising strategies is a pretty short list. And so the question is, why haven't the policy evaluations been more useful in guiding efforts to increase high school graduation rates? I want to talk a bit about that and basically make the case that the kind of interventions that are easiest to evaluate using the quantitative methods that help one to get tenure are not the interventions that have the most promise in improving high school graduation rates. As we'll see, that's kind of a problem I think that we as a research community face. I don't think that the Gates Foundation has it right in arguing that what the goal should be for everybody to get a four-year college education. I do think that to fare well in this changing economy, you're going to at some point in your life need more education and training beyond high school just because the economy is changing so fast. So I think what's really important is that you leave school with the skills to be a good learner going down the line. And I think for a lot of people, you know, we don't understand very well community colleges. I know Mikhail and others are, and Anne are thinking about that and studying that, is to what extent are particular community college programs important. I don't think we understand that very well. But at the same time, and I know the work, David Carr's Eli lecture, where he talked about no difference between dropouts in high school. I'm going to show you some numbers in a minute on race differences by education that make me think it's a little more complicated than that. So how do you measure these? Well, it basically are three data sources. There are these, each of which has problems, household surveys. So basically this is the census, the American Community Survey, Current Population Survey, where they ask large samples of adults what's your highest educational attainment. And you can so you can take the responses. Do they say it's at least a high school diploma? And of course, your question comes right line because you can't, from these household surveys, adequately distinguish GED holders from conventional high school graduates. There is a question now. It started in 2008 in the American Community Survey about if you say you are just a high school graduate with no post-secondary education, they do ask you if you acquired that status by taking the GED, but they don't ask you that question if you reported you had some post-secondary education, so it's incomplete. Also, comparisons of numbers with the GED testing service on counts lead ones to believe that the responses to that question aren't very accurate in any case. So that's one problem, is how do we take out the GEDs from the household survey? Okay, I'll talk about that. The second is the so-called Common Core of Data, you know, that the National Center for Education Statistics collects every year. It comes from every high school is asked to report the number of individuals in each grade level, number of graduates, that goes to the district, that goes to the state, that goes to the feds. Is the most widely reported source of information, high school graduation rates. It's problematic for a reason, and I'll talk about it in a minute. Okay. And the third are these longitudinal surveys. Now, if you're only worried about national numbers, you know, you can look at ELS 2002, NLSY 1997, or go back and look at the earlier surveys. And I think they're not perfect. Jim Heckman and Paul LaFontaine have a 2010 paper in the Review Economics and Statistics that points out some of the problems with these national longitudinal data sets. But I think most people conclude, if you only want national numbers, that's the best evidence. And you can separate the GEDs pretty well in those data sets. The trouble, of course, is you can't really go any more to a smaller geographical unit. Now, however, relatively new data source in most states are these state administrative databases that follow every student in public school longitudinally. And the federal government put a lot of funding, gave a lot of funds to states to help them develop these systems. And in principle, every state in the country now has the capacity to assess, to provide a number on the percentage of kids who are in public school who actually graduate, and whether they do so in 4 years, 5 years, or 6 years. It turns out, I think most people thought this is going to be the way to overcome the problems of the Common Core data. I don't think that's true, and I'm going to show you why in just a minute. There's a real Achilles heel in these. And the Achilles heel comes back to, you know, the data ultimately come from schools, from high schools. And it turns out, you know, so they can count the number of graduates. I think just for a minute can argue that those numbers of graduates are okay. But the question then is, how about kids who left without a high school diploma? Well, you can, in principle, say it's a dropout. Or you can say the child simply disappeared. Or you can say the child transferred. And the incentives to count that the child transferred are very great because children who, quote, transfer are not in the denominator when you count the high school graduation rate. And we've got some data that I can show you if you want. I don't have it. It's a slide I've hidden. But basically, when you look at urban schools in Massachusetts, you see the percentage of kids who, quote, are counted as transfers relative to those who are counted as dropouts or disappeared is vastly higher than it is in suburban schools, looking at the ratios. So I think the problem is, so the federal rules are you're not supposed to count a child as transferred unless you have written documentation about where the child went. Now, if the child went to another public school, you could, in fact, follow them and find them, in principle. But if they go to a private school or they go out of the state, you're lost. And I think what our inference we make from Massachusetts data is the definition of written documentation is very vague. So let me. So what are the problems? Well, why does it turn out to be so hard to match with graduation rates? The real problem is these atypical paths through high school. Kids change schools, students being retained in grade, particularly the percentage of kids retained in ninth grade has grown enormously in this country, and immigration of teenagers. You know, what do you do about them? How do you count them? Some of them go to American high school, some of them don't. So and that's a real problem when you're looking at the household surveys. If you count recent immigrants, they may never have gone to high school in the United States. Do you want to count them in high school graduation rates? Well, it depends what your purpose in counting the graduation rates is. If you wanted looking at evidence on whether Americans high schools are doing a good job, you probably want to take them out. If you're looking about attributes of the labor force, you probably don't want to take them out. Okay, this is a chart that has way too many numbers on it, but let me just point out a couple of things. Now, so I know it's a bit too hard for most of you to see. What this is this is for kids who entered a Massachusetts public high school in the fall of 2005. And then the question is, what happened to those kids over the next 6 years. In other words, we looked in 2012, so where they had at least 6 years to graduate, and we said, what happened to those kids? And so one possibility is they could have graduated on time in 4 years. Another is they could have graduated, but it took them 5 years. Another is they could have graduated, it took them 6 years. Another is they dropped out, and there was clear evidence in the exit codes, they're dropouts. There is, they reported as transfers. That is, they left the Massachusetts public high school, did not go to another Massachusetts public high school, but the at the school level, they were reported to have transferred, meaning they went to a private school or they went to school outside the state. Okay? So that's transfers. Unknown is they simply disappeared from the database and without an exit code. They just didn't come to school one day and but without ever providing information to know what happened to them. The last is, this is the U.S. government's definition of high school graduation rate, if using their rules, and the key there is graduation rate in 4 years, but importantly, eliminating transfers from the denominator. Just a couple of points with all those numbers that are worth pointing out. One is, if you look, for example, at black males, you see, so 55 in Massachusetts, 56% of them are graduating in 4 years. But notice there's another 6.3% that are graduating in more than 4 years. So, the point is, if you are looking at black-white gaps in high school graduation rates or Hispanic-white gaps, the size of those gaps really depends upon how long you give kids to graduate. So 4 year graduation rates are going to have much bigger gaps than 6 years. And one of the things I think is a little crazy is that, the rules that the federal government is laying out for how states are supposed to report high school graduation rates is they're supposed to report 4 year graduation rates. So at the same time, you've got increasing standards high school graduation rates. 75% of the kids in the country have to take exit exams. So they're raising standards of high school graduation, and they're also saying all kids have to take these exit exams to graduate. But we're saying what really matters is that you graduate in 4 years. And this is really, I think, problematic, because in a lot of the urban high school folks we've talked to, they say, if we take kids who come in reading at ninth grade level, we say, look, if you stick with us for 5 or 6 years, we'll help you to learn these skills to graduate, but it's going to take 5 or 6 years. So it's a little odd to think about having an accountability system that says 4 years. So another pattern here, so that's the first issue, is black-white test score gaps, Hispanic-white test score gaps are going to be bigger when you look at CCD data on four-year graduation rates than they are when you look at household data of, say, 20-year-olds where they have more time to graduate. The second thing is, notice these transfer rates. So for Hispanics, you've got 16.3%. And notice it's very, very high. So what you do with those folks who count as transfers, whether you put them in the denominator or not, has a very big impact on the high school graduation rate for particularly Hispanics and to a lesser extent blacks. So again, I think the big story is an awful lot of kids are simply dropping out, and they're being counted as transfers. I mean, that's mm-hmm. and you can think of, unless you want to put an auditor in every urban school, the cost of trying to get more compliance with the directive is going to be very, very high. It's the rules that are laid out in this 29-30-page 2008 federal guidelines are that the receiving school has to include, the receiving public school has to include the child as their client. So in other words, and that's true even if the child were to transfer in the second semester of the 12th grade. So that's the rule that they're supposed to follow. Okay?
One small thing which you may get to later, but I'm curious, later you're going to talk about whether we think about it on time or 5 year or 6 year, how many are sort of leaving before the end of 4th year, like sort of are not present versus not completing the exit exam? So if we think of dropouts as either they stop showing up or not getting the diploma because they're failing to pass the exam.
Well, in Boston, I remember the superintendent, Carol Johnson, has told me 40% of the dropouts have passed the exit exam, the 10th grade exit exams. So that's Boston, so I don't know beyond that.
So a very crude measure would be just simply if you had a good measure of the number of high school graduates to divide that by the number of kids who were in school 4 years earlier in ninth grade or whatever. Right? So that's not perfect. But given all these problems here, it might be a better measure.
Well, that's just what the until fairly recently, until 2006, that's exactly what NCES did. That's ninth grade graduation rates. And am I going to show you why that? Yes, I am going to show you in a couple of minutes the problem with that. Okay. So the first kind of problem with this is that we saw kids have these funny paths through high school that creates difficulties in measuring high school graduation accurately. The second, as you brought up earlier, is this GED, the percentage of high school completers that is reported in household surveys that the high school completers were GED recipients is up around 12%. It's 15% among African Americans, it's substantial. So how you treat GED recipients has a non-trivial impact on your estimate, particularly for particular subgroups. And again, the reason not to count for the high school graduation rates, as we know from work that Jim Heckman and co-authors have done, and we've done some as well, is GED recipients don't fare nearly as well as high school graduates in labor markets. And the explanation for that is quite interesting. It's not that they have lower cognitive skills than terminal high school graduates, meaning high school graduates who don't go on to college. In fact, you look at the distributions, we've done this in Massachusetts, of cognitive skills of terminal high school graduates and GED recipients, they map right on top of each other. But if you look at 8th grade school attendance records, the GED recipients are much more likely to have been absent. So the real problem is, and the reason that GED recipients don't fare very well is, you know, they have dropped out of school. Employers know that. Employers experience, you know, when you think of it, you're hiring somebody for an entry-level job. What's the first thing you most want? Come to work every day on time, right? And here you've got evidence that people weren't very good at that, at least a few years ago. So that's, I think, it's these differences in these, what Jim Heckman calls non-cognitive skills. My friend Larry Katz doesn't like that term because he points out, you know, it's all going through the brain in some sense, right? But, or you could, you know, so you need perhaps another term. But okay, so you really, if you're going to use household surveys to measure high school graduation rates, you really want to take out the GEDs. And we've done that. We were able to get GED Testing Service to give us information for the last 10 years on everybody who got a GED in this country, and we know what state and we know their demographics. So consequently, we can for fine-grained demographic groups, we can subtract off the number of GEDs who went to African-American males of a particular age and a particular year living in a particular state and for every other group. So that's what we've done is to get our estimates of high school graduation rates. Okay. Now, what are the stylized facts? The first is stagnation from 1970 to 2000. The Heckman-LaFontaine paper describes that very nicely. The second is, and this is this increased high school graduation rate between 2000 and 2010. And that's a really quite striking pattern, as I'll show you in a minute. The third is big racial gaps, and that I think are highly publicized, less well publicized, but equally true of these gaps by family income. Just huge. Okay, and if you put these three together, what do you see? And this is what you. So these are Hispanics, these are African Americans, and these are non-Hispanic whites. And notice the remarkable stability. And this is by cohort birth year, so you could add 18 if you wanted to look at expected high school graduation year. You see remarkable stability. You see the race gaps, race ethnicity gaps, and then you see this quite substantial increase in the last decade. Now, NCES just reported an increase based on Common Core data just 2 weeks ago, and some people commenting and they said, oh, that's the effect of the recession, no jobs. But notice that doesn't work, right, in the terms of the timing, because notice the recession's 2007, and this you can think of this as being 2010 in terms, because this comes from American Community Survey data. And so basically the increase started well before the recession, which began at the end of 2007. Hillary?
It's not the ACS, is it? I mean, it looks like it's precisely at the moment where the data store switches to the ACS in 2000 where the starts to look different. Do I have that right? In terms of when's your first ACS year that's generating that data?
Let me think about that. You're right. All these data points are ACS, but I had an answer to that question because I did think of that. Part of the answer is. You see the increase in other data sets. Mm-hmm. You see, in particularly, there's reason to question the Common Core data, but you see it in those data as well. So that you really see them from two independent data sources. Also, we can match up. There was an ACS trial data set from year 2000. And we and others have compared that to the census numbers, and they're pretty right on the money. So I don't think it's ACS, but it's a good possibility. So we've got three stylized facts. The fourth one is this large gender gap favoring females. The Golden Cats book points out this is not a new phenomenon. In 1920. The high school graduation of females was 7% higher than males, 1920. 1950, it was a 5% higher. But interestingly enough, in 1970, they were dead even. And now it's increased again. And of course, an interesting question is why? And there's an interesting paper by Marianne Bertrand and one of her students, Jessica Pan, in the American Economic Journal Applied, it's 2013. It's called The Trouble with Boys. That's got some interesting data that begins to shed light on this gender gap, which you also see in college graduation rates, not surprisingly. So the last two things are the dropout rate appears to be concentrated in a relatively small minority of high schools. About 15% of the nation's high schools, and it appears to be great variation across states, variation that you can't explain, and not even half of by differences in racial ethnic mix. Now, these come from CCD data, because that's currently the only source of data by state. So I'm not 100% sure of the quality of these data. We're trying to generate state-by-state estimates based upon the ACS, and so I'll know more about that soon. Cassie?
I'm thinking about this idea that it is the reforms rather than some kind of societal trend type thing, and obviously...
Well, I haven't said that, right?
Well, no, but you said that yeah. CES, or people who are quoted, invested right. that. So I'm thinking about, how about the private school survey? Do you see similar trends in private school budgets? It's obviously a different...
That's another terrific idea. Terrific idea. The problem with that is, it's a good idea. Worth writing down. The only qualification I'd make is, based upon the ELS 2002 longitudinal survey, the high school graduation rate of kids in private schools is 97%. So there's not a lot of room to move, but it's worth looking at from earlier surveys. That's a nice idea. So I'm not sure about these. But Heather.
I was just hoping you could say something about the change in the racial gap in graduation rate.
Yeah.
It looks like that improved.
You bet. It did. And that's, in fact, I'm going to end the last slide that I've got is a list of four questions that I think want to provide the agenda for at least my group's next steps on this research. And interestingly, though, you see, you're absolutely right, the black-white gaps and the Hispanic-white gaps have closed somewhat. You see that in ACS data. You don't see it in the Common Core data, and I think there are two reasons for this. One reason is the Common Core data are only counting four-year graduation rates, and we saw that a significant percentage of blacks and Hispanics are taking longer than four. The other thing is, following the Heckman-LaFontaine, we began with taking the Heckman-LaFontaine numbers and being sure we could, in fact, implement their methodology and get exactly the same numbers. Then we updated it, and then we used to follow their exact methods in the ACS. One thing they do is they exclude our recent immigrants from the analytic samples. So anybody who came to the U.S. after the age of 11 are excluded. The idea being that they wanted to focus on what's happening with some sense the ability of high schools to get kids through. A lot of these kids, about three out of five immigrants who came to the age of the U.S. after the age of 11 are Hispanic. And among those age 20 to 24 in 2010, of those recent Hispanic immigrants, only less than half have a high school diploma. Now, whether they came to American high school and didn't graduate, or whether they never went to American high school, you don't know from the ACS. But the point is, it makes a big difference, because if you include those, it's going to affect graduation rates in California, in Texas, New Mexico and Arizona a lot.
This narrowing is in levels, but if you think of it in proportion of people who drop out and the percentage change in that, then it's much similar. It's roughly about 25% improvement in the dropout rate for both. It's a little bit more still for the minority. But if you just view this as school of at-risk people, now we're reaching 25% of them, then it is more similar.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. All right, so we've gotten up to here, I think. So these are the patterns, and now I want to turn to what are the explanations for these? Now, my training is in economics, and this was a paper written for an economics journal, so it won't surprise you that I focus on the economic the kinds of variables that economists think about. And first is, you know, what's the payoff to high school graduation? This is going to come back to your question there. The second is the opportunity cost. You know, there's, some of you may know this early work by Dan Black and his colleagues, very nice, where they looked at the coal boom in western Pennsylvania in the 1970s, and the net effect is the coal boom led to a significant increase in the high school dropout rate because there were good high-paying jobs. Then when the coal boom turned to a coal bust, the dropout rate declined. So there is evidence from other people's work. Whether that plays a role here, I don't think so in these recent trends. So third is this rate of time discount. You know, again, since this basically is how patient are you? So it might be that there's good economic payoff in terms of lifetime income streams to getting a high school diploma, but if it means you have to go to school now instead of working for pay now, and if you're a very impatient person, you might decide that I value the income now more than in the future. So the question is, does that play a role? And after thinking about this over and over again, I was reminded of a paper in the Journal of Economic Literature by Becker and someone else from about year 2000, pointing out that in some sense, rates of time discount are endogenous, to use the kind of economics term. That is, they're influenced by a variety of things, including the way children are growing up. And in fact, I mean, we have increasing evidence on early childhood experiences in affecting kids, patients, affecting a whole variety of kids' personality characteristics. So in some sense, that's not a separate variable, I think, in an economic terms in this context. And the last term is this non-monetary cost of completing another year of high school. Now, that turns out to be quite important in this story. Now, if I were trained in sociology, I would be breaking up this fourth one into about a whole bunch of different subcategories, because this is, you know, peer groups, school culture, all kinds of things that are the realm of sociologists. I tried to read a lot of that work, but I put it into one category. Okay, so what's the evidence here? So on the predicted payoff, if we simply look at, this is current population survey data, and if we simply look at what are the constant dollar trends in mean hourly wages for high school dropouts, high school graduates, and four-year college graduates, we see, in fact, if you look very, very closely, this is a speck wider than that, but not much. It's a bit wider than that for the females. But it looks as if the payoff to high school surely didn't decline and seems really quite substantial. So this is kind of partly response to this question of whether, if high school graduates, if high school graduates are completely interchangeable with dropouts, you wouldn't see this pattern, I don't think. Now then, if you look...
Sorry, the change, I mean, if you think about, has this changed in the last 30 years, then there is a significant change in the position of college, but not of the other two.
Fair enough. I agree with that. For males...
For males.
Mm-hmm.
If you put in a fourth line, which is some college group, because you were talking about, you know, it's not access to a college degree, but maybe a little additional training. Do you see anything?
Not much, but again, you know, the trouble, particularly since they changed this census, you know, what, in 93, I think it is. So there's this problem of, what do we mean? And so... I agree, it's interesting. I thought about that, but I couldn't figure out a definition that I found comparable. Now, what about if you break it out by race, ethnicity? And basically what you see here, so these are ratio of high school dropouts, high school graduate mean hourly wage. And with the exception of this odd pattern for Hispanic males, notice for all the others, is downward sloping. So although high school graduates didn't do wonderfully between 80 in 2008. The relative wage of high school graduates relative to dropouts was better. That was dropout, the ratio of dropouts wage to high school graduates rates declined for all male, for all female groups and for all males except for the Hispanics. Now, so when you look at that, you might say, gee, it doesn't seem, if we want to explain this stagnation, high school graduation rates, from these data, it looks as if, gee, it looks as if there was a pretty good return to graduating from high school. So maybe we should look a little further. Now, one story you might say is, you know, you're only in the sample from which these numbers are generated if you're working. And so this is always the question, you know, economists worry about was selection bias out of the labor market. And we know, in fact, that the employment-to-population ratio for dropouts has declined enormously, particularly for males. And if we looked at black males, it would be even more precipitous. So the question, this is a point, you know, again, Jim Heckman has made, is, you know, you might think there really is a, you know, when we look at this prior picture, these are averages. But it might very well be that for kids who are entering high school with pretty weak skills, there may not be this kind of payoff, and that's why they drop out. So that's the possibility. But then you got to ask the question, how do you have the one literature that says, you know, heterogeneous payoffs, high school diploma, that it's not going to be much benefit for kids who have very weak skills. Say. That's one story. But then you have this so-called compulsory schooling studies that at least the economists among you know. There are several of them. Phil Oreopoulos has done. And basically those are studies in which researchers used changes in school leaving requirements. Typically states or whole countries increase the number of years of schooling, increase the minimum age yet to attain before you could legally leave school. So they use that as the kind of a source of exogenous variation to ask this question, does completing another year of school buy you anything? And of course that's the methodology they use is focusing on these kids who are right on the margin, who would have liked to have dropped out. And the payoff to that, to this extra year school is remarkably consistent. It buys you 10% extra earnings across these studies. So you got to say then, how do you fit these together?
Marianne? Those studies are based on variation from a significantly long time ago.
Yes. Phil has one.
Phil has one.
In the book by...
Phil has one using more recent...
Yes.
I don't remember enough about that one to know.
It's in this NBR volume edited by the health guy at MIT.
But in general,
thank you.
The literature is based on variation and...
fair enough.
Right. So right. It could be that there are differences in those returns.
Right. So, but I think the... let me ask, how many of you know what instrumental variables are? Okay. All right. Some, but not all the grad students. Okay. So this is
ask again. I didn't look to see. I think people over there should have raised their hand.
I see. So here's the story to reckon. So the question is, can you fit together the finding of the compulsory schooling studies and if we believe Phil's recent study? How do you fit that together with Jim Heckman's idea that really for kids who are coming to high school, not really with very good, solid cognitive skills, that high school diploma might not buy you much? And the story, I think, is, and this is an insight Kevin Lang, who's a terrific labor economist, provided, is, but think about what the instrumental variables for how it works is you're using the instrument, the change in the school leaving age, to predict number of years of completed schooling, and you get exogenous variation in that you then use to predict subsequent wages. Well, the striking thing is that for a lot of kids, increasingly in recent years, staying in school another year does not lead to another year of completed schooling. And you see this, so as a result of which, they're not influenced. And you see this if you look carefully at Phil's most recent paper, and you look at the coefficient on in the appendix to that paper in the book, the first stage equation, you don't get a statistically significant impact for blacks. So for blacks, the rule you have to stay in school for another year did not lead to an increase in the number of years of schooling completed. So you see this looking at, this is Massachusetts data. So this is the percentage of Massachusetts first time ninth graders who repeated grade 9. And notice urban low income. More than 1 in 4 kids are repeating grade 9. Then you ask the question, among those who repeated grade 9, what percentage of them graduate within 6 years? And what you see is for urban low income, it's 30%. So in some sense, failing to get out of grade 9 in 1 year means for a lot of these kids, they're not going to graduate from high school. We do know from the NAEP transcript studies that kids are taking more science and more math now than they were 30 years ago. Now, but that doesn't, question is what's in those courses. And that I think is more difficult to define. So I don't know the answer beyond number of courses. That's a good point. Now, so explaining the increase. I gave a talk, I guess at the New York Fed about a year ago, and an economist named Joydeep Roy, who had done some interesting work on high school graduation rates, he pointed out, well, you know, if this is real, if it's not Hillary's ACS problem, if it's real, then shouldn't you see this in increase in national educational progress 8th grade scores at the bottom of the distribution? That is, because we know 8th grade test scores are pretty good predictors of high school graduation rates. So if this is real, shouldn't we be seeing an increase in the 8th grade NAEP scores? And it turns out, you do. This is math, and this is reading. This is 25th percentile. So we haven't done all the quantile work that you and Marianne have done, Hillary, but we've done a little bit looking at low. So if you look at the 10th percentile, you see the same thing. Why look at the bottom distribution? Because, of course, they're the kids who are most likely not to graduate. And you see in math, so these are white, these are non-Hispanic whites. These are blacks and Hispanics. And the 25th percentile. And we see beginning about the late 1990s, substantial increase. And for reading, it's a bit more complicated because you get this big decline in reading scores, particularly for blacks. But you do get an increase starting in about 1995. So now that doesn't tell you, of course, the same question is, why the increase in high school graduation rate? Well, why the increase in these 8th grade NAEP scores? You know, we still don't know the answer. But at least it's somewhat consoling, I hope.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of 3 federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.